Are you satisfied with your understanding of sustainability? If you are not, imagine a journey together, a pluralistic one, with academia, innovators, startups, NGOs, all looking for solutions to the greatest challenge of our time. My name is Samuele Tini, and this is the Sustainability Journey. Welcome to a new episode. And we have discussed a lot in the podcast what we can do, how also activism and the civil society can be part of the solution and what we can do as citizens. And we do it with somebody that has been a leader at the forefront of the biggest civil society organization, name it, Greenpeace, Amnesty International, and now is a global activist, a published author, and a leader. I am the pleasure and honor to welcome Kumi Naidu. Kumi, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kumi, your career is impressive, the curriculum and the work and what you have done in the past with your leadership position now as an activist, as an author, it's really impressive. But our usual question, as fast, I know we want also to jump on that, is who is Kumi? What is your sustainability journey? How also your early life in South Africa has shaped your progression to become a global leader?
So I was born in Durban, South Africa, in a working class township called Chatsworth. And I got involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, specifically around education, when I was 15 in a national student uprising, and was expelled for that. But that expulsion from school just sort of basically was an encouragement to become more active. So I was very involved in the liberation struggle, in youth organizing, student organizing, and grassroots community and civic organizing. Then when repression got really bad, I fled South Africa into exile. I was lucky, I had a scholarship to Oxford, and I basically did my PhD at Oxford. And then the moment Mandela was released, I returned back home, started helping preparing the ANC to be a legal political party and to prepare for the elections, but made the decision not to go into government and to stay out to continue to strengthen civil society. Because one of the jokes we used to say during that time after the elections was that the term NGO no longer stood for non-governmental organization, but stood for next government official, because so many people from the NGO sector moved into government. Then after several years in the adult education movement, and one of the worst legacies of the apartheid system was leaving our people unable to read and write. And so I put my energies into that. And then 2 years after democracy in 1996, I was part of the group that helped set up the South African NGO Coalition to be an interlocutor and an advocate for the interests of civil society. And in that role, I helped evolve a sort of approach which we call critical solidarity, meaning that, of course, we were in broad solidarity with the government, the first democratic government in the country, and all of that. But we said that that solidarity had to be on the basis of criticism. Because one of the things that the government often would say is, oh, don't make those demands because it's going to take us a long term time to reverse the legacy of apartheid. You can't change the legacy, which we agreed with. However, if you saw government going off in a wrong direction, why should we give them more time to continue going in the wrong direction? So we, from the get-go, were quite, you know, the South African NGO Coalition played a very important role in shaping the relationship between the state and civil society. Then, you know, it became clear to me more and more that, you know, even if we had good governments and good governance on the African continent, the reality is that many powerful decisions around climate, around trade, around economy, around finance, and so on, are all made at the global level. And so part of what I wanted to do was to look at how we could contribute to strengthening civil society globally. So then I became the Secretary General of Civicus World Alliance for Citizen Participation for about 10 years, which was defending the space for civil society. And from there, I went on to be the head of Greenpeace International for 6 years. And then in between that and becoming the head of Amnesty, I spent 2 years mostly as a volunteer working to set up Africans Rising for Justice, Peace and Dignity. I now put a lot of my energy into addressing one of the key challenges of the moment we find ourselves as activists, and that is we are not succeeding to communicate, especially on climate, the urgency and clarity of why people need to act on a much bigger scale than any other movement has been able to mobilize people to act. Because if we fully understand the scale that we are facing, then what is needed is, in fact, the largest level of citizen mobilization that we've ever seen on this planet before. Because as Naomi Klein says in this book, in a book, This Changes Everything, you know, on climate, we have to recognize that incremental changes are not going to get us where we need to. We have to change our economic system and so on. So part of my energies now go into supporting the Community Arts Network, which is very much focused on promoting artivism, which is about harnessing the power of arts and culture to reach a much larger number of people. I also had a personal tragedy. My son committed suicide almost 2 years ago, and I put quite a lot. He was a famous musician and very, very successful in terms of mobilizing people around his music and so on. And so we have a foundation called the Ricky Rick Foundation for the Promotion of Artivism, which is building on his legacy as well as supporting mental health. And currently, I'm based for the next 11 months in Stanford University, where I'm visiting lecturer for a year, working on these issues.
Thank you, Kumi, also for sharing your journey, a successful one. You had your also ups and downs, and I think you are overcoming also and supporting and using it as a power, not to transform and work in this space, empowering people and put them become active in solving the problems. And I really want to ask one, you have mentioned we have a problem. And since we are on the sustainability journey, I wanted to ask, because of your long experience, the link and the relationship between environmental justice, human rights, how social justice, all these words that we hear and discuss, if you can clarify, and also understand which is the, how they operate together and can be complemented rather than working in isolation. And I'm sure you have plenty of examples from your previous experience and your recent experience. And now this, we can put together these two important parts.
So when I joined Greenpeace in 2009, I had to do a lot of interviews, you know, with media in different parts of the world. And one of the questions that I got asked in different shapes and forms, but essentially people were saying, oh, you're mainly an anti-poverty activist and a human rights and democracy and gender equity person. Are you leaving all of that to now go to the environment? And my answer then in 2009 was the struggle to avert catastrophic climate change and ensure environmental sustainability, and the struggle for social and economic justice more broadly can, must, and should be seen as two sides of the same coin. And one of the disservices that Western environmentalism did was allowing climate change to be framed as an environmental issue. Climate change is a cross-cutting issue. It's about our economy, it's about our energy system, it's about our agricultural system, our transport system, and so on. And what is needed right now is for us to listen to what the feminist movement taught us decades ago, when they said it was critically important that we embrace the idea of intersectionality. If you want to advance the question of women's rights, you can't do that without understanding how that intersects with race, with class, with religion, with ability, and all of those things. So if you look at the Global South, for example, and one of the main kind of hesitations that many governments profess when they are being asked to move in the direction of urgent climate action. They say, well, the people in the rich countries of the world, they dominated us economically by exploiting fossil fuels. And now they are saying to us that, oh, you cannot use fossil fuels. And they still continue to use and give trillions of dollars in subsidies. But what we try to say to our governments is, understand, if we are sharp and strategic, we don't have to see it as a loss, right? Because the successful countries, companies, organizations of the future are those that get as far ahead of the green economy, inclusive green economy curve now, right? So for example, if you look at job creation potential, when we look at energy options, right? When we look at, say, now some countries are looking at nuclear as a possibility, when nuclear is too expensive, too dangerous, and will deliver too little too late in terms of addressing climate, right? Nuclear industry, for example, in terms of job creation, creates some highly specialized jobs for some highly qualified people. But once it's all set up and the thing is constructed, it's not a big job creator. And in any case, nuclear now is significantly more expensive than solar and wind, and we shouldn't be doing that, as well as safety and other considerations. So the best projects I have seen around the world is ones where, for example, you do an energy intervention, right? Like say even with solar, right? But you construct it in a way that you think about using the land below for agriculture or certain kinds of agriculture and so on. So it's critically important right now that any environmental intervention needs to have a significant social component where we are enhancing people's health, employment creation, and so on. And if we are able to do that more successfully, I think we can get more governments, especially in the global south, to move much faster than they are currently moving. Let me just say, I have sympathy with countries in the global south.
Yes.
For the hypocrisy of the global north in terms of how they have functioned on this. I mean, you saw Europe, for example, where like pushing everybody to go in a particular direction. And suddenly, when the horrible invasion of Ukraine happens, then the Europeans are far too important not to have energy, right? So therefore, they then start expanding again in fossil fuels and so on. And this is a kind of double standard that we must address if we are to move forward. So it's not as if we're saying to governments in the global south, you don't have a legitimate grievance here. You do, but you cannot bury your head in the sand when it is our people in the global south that are paying the first and most brutal impacts of climate change. And that is why we have campaigned and succeeded in campaigning for, amongst other things, the Green Climate Fund and the Loss and Damage Fund. Admittedly, it was a big struggle to get those things in place, and still the global north is not fulfilling its responsibility to make sure money flows into that. But I think intersectional approach, and I think if in the Rio summit in 1992, when we first recognized, and if you go and look at the details of it, the intersectionality was all over the place, right? It's always been there, but sadly, political power brokers don't seem to embrace it as they need to.
Thank you so much, Kumi, for this analysis. And I want to take some of your reflection and going a bit further to see. You have been a critic, and you know, of bodies, rightly, I would say, of bodies like World Economic Forum, the Epoxy of the West, and you are elaborating a vision of system redesign. How we can address this part, how we can redesign our system and to address our planetary crisis.
So, you know, at first people might be moved to think, oh, this guy is sounding very radical, yeah. But actually, what I am saying is no different what the G20 said in their meeting in London in 2009, okay, where they said, we need to stop fossil fuel subsidies, right, which run into the multiple trillions of dollars. Basically, governments giving oil, coal, and gas companies subsidies because generating energy is in the national interest. True, there is some small money now in comparative terms that's going to renewable energies, also through subsidies. In 2009, they agreed that they would scrap fossil fuel subsidies. In fact, if you go and look at it, it's actually increased in terms of collectively, globally, what it's been. So that's the kind of system change. The second is to stop selling the lie that everybody in the world can have the level of consumption that the folks in Europe and North America, for example, in the global north, enjoy. Because decades ago, WWF said, if we had to deliver the same standard of living that people have in Europe to everybody on the planet, we would need between 5 and 8 planets. Okay? So we have one planet, and therefore we have to think the system change that we need is to move to address the biggest disease that humanity faces. And it's not COVID, by the way. It's a disease you could call affluenza. Affluenza is a pathological illness where people have been led by the corporate sector in particular and certain governments into believing that a good, decent life comes from more and more and more material acquisitions. And therefore, we see so many people having a disconnect with nature, disconnect with their neighbors and community. We have a mental health crisis that, you know, is sometimes now finally people are talking about eco-anxiety and climate anxiety and so on. So we need to be thinking about, and the thing is, the universe is always teaching us things, but we don't learn the lessons. You know, after the global financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, and particularly now after COVID, both those crises showed the inequality in the world, the vulnerability that poor people face. I mean, we, in terms of North-South dynamics, you know, we're dealing with the issue of climate apartheid. And of course, we have been, you know, the blatant vaccine apartheid that we saw during COVID, where people in Africa got the vaccines like 1 year after people in Europe got it and so on. So we have to recognize that the system is broken, right? But what we saw as an approach was all about system after COVID and after the financial crisis and previous crises, including, for example, the 1997 Asian financial crisis. The approach is system recovery, system protection, system maintenance. But what was needed after the financial crisis and even now after COVID was system innovation, system redesign, and system transformation. So I'll go far as saying that we need fundamental structural change and systemic change. Incremental baby steps in the right direction will not be able to secure our children and their children's future. And whether it's our food system, whether it's our transport system, whether it's our economic system in particular, these systems collectively give us the climate crisis. The climate crisis just doesn't happen, right? It's because, if anything, the main thing the climate crisis is a failure of our economic system, right? Because it was an economic system that drove us, you know, some have called it the military-industrial complex. Now we call it the military fossil fuel industry complex. And, you know, we should not underestimate our big structural power is holding us from making changes. So that is the kind of ambition that we need to see moving forward in a context where the window of opportunity to act to avert catastrophic, runaway, irreversible climate change is small and closing quite fast.
Thank you, Kumi. And I want now to ask to go a bit deeper on one discussion that we have. We have many people, especially in the Global Summit, there is this divide. I've been at COP, I've been at other discussions, you see the divide from the Global South, the Global North. And you have been painstaking voice that is trying to support, and especially from the civil society part. And you have founded, and you have also the founding chair of the African Risings for Justice, Peace and Dignity organization. And you have laid the ground and discussed the Kilimanjaro Declaration. Now you have updated. Which are the principle and goal for the declaration? How this relates with the climate crisis and the role, especially of Africa within the Global South?
The main message of Africans Rising in the past and today is that we desperately need the maximum level of social, economic, political integration of the African countries. Basically, the boundaries of the countries that make up Africa was not determined by the peoples of Africa. It was determined at a conference in Berlin where European colonial powers got together and carved up the continent. So while we cannot reverse fundamentally the legacy of colonialism, slavery, and so on, we have to move forward now, including looking at what we can learn from the European Union experiment. Right? So when the European Union adopted the euro, I immediately said in 2000, if Europe can have a euro, I don't see why Africa can't have an afro. And I wasn't referring to the hairstyle, but I was referring to, so to address the different challenges that we face, including the climate challenge, we are saying that Africa's best chance is to mobilize the greatest level of Pan-African unity to be able to stand on global platforms and engage the United Nations and other structures like COP and so on with greater effectiveness, greater unity, and so on. But for Africa, the climate crisis is the biggest thing that we face. And people must be very clear that already we are seeing the hand of climate change in terms of migration patterns, droughts, flooding, internal displacement, and so on. And we don't even need the science anymore to tell us that we've got a problem. We can see it with our own eyes. And therefore, Africans Rising is playing an important role in mobilizing trade unions, NGOs, faith organizations, and individuals into working to address the challenge of corruption, gender equity, economic equity, and climate injustice.
And those are what's in academia, no? The institutional voids, the many voids that they are in there, and which are, I think, hindering the development of one of the areas that is supposed to be the most populous, the most growing areas will be in 2050 and 2100, will be the most populous area in the world. So it's really important now. And I really like that part because, as we know, and we live, especially having lived in so many countries in Africa, my experience, when you pass the border, you get another language. However, the ethnic group, or what we call here again the tribe, is the same. And there were people, there were no boundaries, but they were now put a boundary there, which sometimes is an hindrance and can be also a moment of tension. So I want to ask now this question. You know, we have discussed, okay, redesign, the role of Africa and the work and support of the civil society. I want to know now, civil society, it is also not very welcome sometimes in our world. I want to add this bit of reflection because from all part of the world, being in our continent, being in Europe, in mainstream media and others, or even in Asia, the word NGO, civil society, is now looked by suspicion. Activism, as you say, this radicalism, and how we can change also a bit this now. What, how we can really show that we need our activism and work to really change and not have them framed as, oh, the typical bunch of idealists of radical guys, which are now destructive even or poisonous, as some politicians all over the country, they're saying, telling us.
Right now, Civicus World Alliance for Citizen Participation, which tracks the space for civil society in different countries, has been shouting out for more than a decade that the space for civic action is shrinking. Whether it's in the north or in the south, whether it's in countries that claim to be promoters of democracy or not, we're seeing it everywhere, right? And let me give you a statistic that is horrifying. Global Witness, the highly respected NGO which works on these issues, shows that about 10 years ago, they used to say that on average, weekly, two environmental activists were being killed. Now, on average, four environmental activists are killed every single week in the Amazon, in the Congo Basin forests, in Sumatra, and a range of other places around the world. So what we are finding is that apart from trying to fight for climate justice, we have to fight for the survival of civil society. And yeah, my appeal to organizations of civil society, whether you're in gender equity, whether you're in urban development, rural development, and so on, you've got to make some time to contribute to defending the collective space for civil society. Because quite frankly, all the promise that we had when the Berlin Wall came down is not actually being fulfilled, right? You know, there was supposed to be the peace dividend. We were supposed to, you know, stop spending so much of money on military expenditure and more on health and education and so on. But actually, we still see a horrendous spike in military expenditure, for example. So defending civil society space will continue to be a very, very important imperative in what we need to do.
And thank you, because I can really see, and we know, and the work, having been also in the space for more than 20 years, you can see that the space is really reducing. And I want to ask a question about the trends. One of the trends in global activism is the role of technology, social media, and what, how this has changed also a bit the landscape of activism.
So I think on the positive side, it's been able to bring many, many more people into activism. People are not dependent solely on, you know, brand name organizations like Greenpeace and Amnesty. If you take the most significant citizen mobilization for justice that we have seen, probably was the resistance to authoritarian rule in the Arab world, which some people call, you know, the Arab Spring. My friends there say, don't call it the Arab Spring, because that seems to suggest that the struggle for justice is a seasonal activity. And so if you look at Arab resistance to injustice that started with Tunisia, there were very limited mainstream NGO contribution to that. It was people using Facebook to organize it, then using Twitter to tell people to go to this place at this time, and then using YouTube to say, oh, this is what we did, and this is why you should join us. And so what we are seeing on the positive side is that it has contributed to transnational organizing in particular, as well as within countries, in very, very powerful ways. And it also means, from a repression point of view, it's harder to repress organizations that are more decentralized, less bureaucratic, more volunteer driven, and so on. But I do want to just conclude by noting on the negative side that it's also allowed the emergence of fascism. We see how Donald Trump used Facebook micro targeting to win the 2016 election, where they weaponized all sorts of identities, and they use xenophobia and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and so on as ways of mobilizing. So I don't think we should just look at the technological side as net positive, because there has been a very negative sort of reality with seeing the rise of fascism from the United States to Europe and other parts of the world at the moment.
And no, thank you, Kumir, for the reflection. Of course, as all the technology is neutral, and then is how the people are using, positively or negatively. And now, let me put myself in the feet of our listeners. Okay, you have been at the forefront of big names. Now you are discussing putting activism. So, but then, what we can do as citizens can work and save the world. And I think one One of the book, the latest book you wrote is like Boiling Point. Can citizen action save the world? Is kind of significant to that. And we want to understand how citizens, that usually are the lowest part, not government, not enterprise, not multinationals, save the world. So how they can do, which actions that we can undertake to effectively address this crisis?
So let me say this. Firstly, right, were it not for citizen action and civil society mobilization around the economy, for economic justice, for climate justice, and so on, the world would be in a substantially horrible place right now. Certainly on climate, if it wasn't for all the mobilization and activism, bad as it still is, it would have been game over on climate and game over for humanity. And people must be very clear. You know, it's not a question about saving the planet or saving the environment. The planet needs no saving, right? Because if we continue on the trajectory that we're on, we destroy our water resources, the planet heats up to the point we can't grow food, and so on. The end result is we will be gone. The planet will still be here, right? We as a species will disappear. The planet will still be here. And truth be said, for everybody who's concerned about saving the planet, once we become extinct as a species, the oceans will recover, the forests will grow back, and so on. So we need to understand that the struggle to avert catastrophic climate change is nothing less and nothing more than saving our children and their children's futures. Having said that, because activism starts off at a point where we are focused on how people are oppressed, marginalized, excluded, repressed, and so on, sometimes, in fact, quite often, especially when we're talking about international organizations within civil society, which sadly are still very dominated in the North and still have very obvious reflections of structural racism. You know, if you look at the starting point, and the starting point basically is one where the starting point, have I lost you? So the starting point sometimes ends up with people thinking that because people have suffered so much, colonialism, slavery, all of that, that they have much less agency than in reality they have. So my message is basically there are multiple pathways to climate justice and there are multiple pathways for popular participation. And we have to put people at the center of our efforts and so on. So, for example, harnessing our arts, culture, indigenous wisdom, all of those things. So to put it simply, we don't want everybody to do what, you know, the kinds of things I used to do when I was at Greenpeace, which is go to Greenland and Russia and occupy oil rigs and so on. Some people can do that fine. People need to choose things that give their lives joy and meaning and purpose, right? And they, so if you're an art teacher, go support young emerging artists and young people to do murals that educate people about the threat of climate injustice and deepening inequality. If you are a electrician, right? See if you can support the community to do some small renewable energy grid, for example, right? So think about what skills you have, right? And what things you enjoy doing and bring that to the struggle. So lawyers, we need lawyers all over the world for climate litigation, environmental litigation more broadly, and also to get our people out of prison or out of other repression. So people who are lawyers, okay, that's a much clearer area. People generally, lawyers know how they can contribute. But so my point is, we are not harnessing the capability of quote unquote ordinary people. And in my experience, so-called ordinary people are the ones who extraordinarily are the ones that actually deliver big change and so on, without us embracing the idea that ordinary people can contribute extraordinarily, if we create an enabling environment for such participation, is what we need to do.
Fantastic. And those pathways are really a message that we can really leave to our audience, and we can put also some advice and ways we can do, because it's, I really like what you said, the power of ordinary citizen, rather than feeling that, oh, I'm just a citizen, a poor person, or somebody sitting, I don't know where in the planet, and say, I can never do anything. It is such a also revolutionizing message, and also give powers of agency to people, whatever ban and everything. Fantastic. So I really want to thank you so much, Kumi, for your wonderful episode, and really has been a pleasure and honor.
Thank you so much, and good luck to you and your listeners. I hope that we can recognize that the moment of history that we find ourselves is one in which we do not have the luxury of pessimism. The pessimism that emerges from our analysis, our observations, and our lived experience can, must, and should be countered by the optimism of our thought, our actions, our courage. So I urge your listeners to recognize that each and every one is ordinary citizen. We have a simple choice. We are either part of the problem or part of the solution. And choosing to be neutral and inactive in the current context that we find ourselves, sadly, will be making a choice to be part of the problem. Thank you very much for having me on the sustainability journey.
Thank you so much, Kumi. It's been a pleasure and honor. Are you satisfied after this wonderful episode? Let's continue together our sustainability journey.